Chapter 2. Rose's three brothers lived in Cleveland. All three were built like fire hydrants with large, round heads. They had light brown hair and various combinations of blue and green in their eyes, depending upon how the light fell across their faces. They wore Oxford shirts and double-breasted suits with subdued ties, even on weekends. Rose boasted that her brother Bob's clothes were hand-tailored. He had a different stick pin for each tie. Bob Firestone was the oldest, a gangster wannabe since he was a kid. Sadie, his wife, was a small, mousy, strictly observant Jewish woman who'd come from the old country when she was 5 years old. They hardly spent any time together because he was so busy with his business. She didn't much care. To her way of thinking, he supported her and their children in style. She'd come from Poland with nothing. Now she had three furs, one fox stole, one pink jacket, and one full-length mink coat. She had a string of real pearls and a one-carat diamond on her finger. Sadie already knew about Bob's criminal career when they met, including his time as a bootlegger and a stint in jail in 1928. Before that, he'd gotten away with petty crimes like shoplifting and pickpocketing. Nothing to write home about. What Sadie didn't know was that Bob's former girlfriend had shot him in the stomach. Bob sometimes silently reminisced about that day. He had not yet met Sadie. Irene was obsessed with him. To Bob, she'd been just another girl, but after she chanced to see him flirting with that pretty little waitress, she'd exploded in anger once they got home. Both had fiery tempers. "What's she to you, Bob? Ain't I enough?" Irene had yelled. "Nothing. She ain't nothing to me, honey bunch," he had cajoled. "You're lying to me. I saw you kissing and giggling with her. You don't giggle with me." Irene had been cooking. Bob got angry, so he pushed Irene's hand onto the hot plate and held it there. In return, she shot him in the belly with his own gun. Bob walked himself to the hospital, clutching his belly, blood seeping through his fingers. He told the nurse he'd accidentally shot himself and gave a fake home address. About the time Bob was staggering through the hospital door, the police received a phone call about a disturbance and that a man had been shot. It turned out to be Bob's real address. "What are you pulling?" said the plainclothes cop standing at the foot of Bob's hospital bed, who'd introduced himself as Detective Mike Wasserman. "Sorry, Detective," said Bob diffidently. "I didn't want to get my girlfriend in trouble." "What's the story? We'll find out anyway. It's better if you tell us your version of events." Bob hesitated, trying to seem reluctant to squeal on his girlfriend, while thinking this was as good a way as any to get Irene out of his life. "She shot me. We had a fight, and she shot me. That's the truth." "Where's she now?" "I don't know, Detective, I tell you, but I really don't know." The police eventually found Irene in the doctor's office getting her hand bandaged. At the station, she admitted shooting Bob. "She says she won't press charges," Wasserman told Bob. "She says she still loves you." "Okay, well, if she won't, then I won't either. I just want to get stitched up and go home." When Bob got home from the hospital, Irene wasn't there. He packed his things and left. Looking back on that day, Bob had to admit that Irene had done him a favor. If she hadn't sent him to the hospital, he might not have met Wasserman, who turned out to be a thoroughly bent cop. Wasserman had been a big help a couple of times when Bob ran into trouble. Usually a C-note would get the job done. It was a pity when Wasserman moved to New York, but they still kept in touch from time to time. Bob steered well clear of Irene and soon met Sadie, who was quiet except when screaming at her children like a good Jewish mother. She stayed out of his business. He liked it when people stayed out of his business. Max, his brother, worked selling insurance door-to-door. Like Bob, he had an eye for a pretty face. Sylvia, Max's wife, was glamorous looking without being fussy. Max's infidelity was as much a part of him as his hand or his face. The brothers kept each other's secrets. Izzy, his youngest brother, never bothered Bob. He was a painter and sculptor who seemed too honest and clean for his own good. His wife Gladys was a talent agent who traveled a lot, so he had every opportunity to see other women. But to Bob's knowledge, he didn't. Maybe he was afraid of losing Gladys. She was a strong-willed woman married to a boring man. Maybe she loved Izzy because he allowed her to be that way. They'd known each other since they were kids. By 1930, Bob was running the Glaze Wright Company, which installed glass windows all over Cleveland. His buddies in the Mayfield Road Mob had given money to start the business, and one of them came by every week to pick up their cut. They also made sure that he got plenty of business. Bob knew the methods they used, but had to admit that he didn't have the knack himself. That encounter with Isaac Gross, supervisor and contact man for the American Store Equipment and Construction Corporation, had been particularly embarrassing. He'd slipped uninvited into the diner booth across from Gross and said, "Isaac, my friend, what will it take to convince you?" Gross, who was drinking a cup of coffee and downing a corned beef on rye, looked up in surprise. "What do you want, Bob? Can't you let a guy eat in peace?" "Nothing, Isaac, nothing, really. I just want us to be pals. You know, the kind of pals who look out for each other. The kind of pals who don't do business elsewhere when they got a perfectly good place to do business right under their nose." Bob slowly squashed what remained of his cigar in the ashtray next to Isaac's elbow. "What's in it for me, Bob? You got yourself into some trouble, haven't you? Now you're coming to me for help. I like it. Funny how the tables can turn." Bob moved his upper body across the table. He took the pickle off Isaac's plate and bit off the end. "What a pickle! This place has the best in town. So crisp you can probably hear the crunch all the way over there," he said, pointing behind Isaac toward the back of the diner. Isaac took a quick glance over his shoulder, then swiveled his head back to find that Bob had leaned across the table so far that their faces were almost touching. At that range, he could see every vein in Bob's bloodshot eyes, the twitch in his lips, and the minute flaring in his nostrils. "This guy's scared," he thought, "and thinks he can scare me." Bob tried another tack, saying, "I'll give you $1,500 now and another $1,500 later if you refuse to testify against Don Campbell." "Bob, what can I tell you? You guys forced those contractors to use your company. After you wrecked the one downtown, they were too afraid not to." "What do you mean, we wrecked the one downtown? Where do you get your information? Are you going to help me out with this or not?" said Bob in a low voice behind the newspaper he was holding to screen the conversation. It was probably unnecessary since the place was packed and so noisy he could barely hear Isaac's response. "I'll think it over." "Yeah? Think fast, you creep," said Bob, vainly trying to sound ominous. "I thought we was pals," said Isaac out loud as Bob rose and stalked out. "Firestone," he thought. "Thinks he's such a big shot. Acting like he's Capone himself." Bob was in a foul mood when he left the diner. He chased Gross all over town before finding him there. He should have known that wasn't the place to strong-arm someone, especially if it was short, heavy, and didn't look very frightening. Bob preferred intimidating potential strikers because the Mayfield boys would always send a little muscle to help. The factory bosses, most of whom were connected, all knew him and paid well for the service. Then one day he got a call from Mike Wasserman, who is now working as a detective in Brooklyn. He knew that Mike was still on the take and well connected with one of the New York mobs. "Hey, Bob," Wasserman had said when Bob answered the phone, "I need a favor. Mikey, old pal, what can Bob do for you? Well, one of my friends here in Brooklyn asked me to find a local lawyer to get a guy out of trouble. Don't you have a brother or somebody who's a shyster here? My brother-in-law, yeah, what's the charge? Murder. Yikes. Yeah, they want someone who's squeaky clean, not connected to the family, and can keep his mouth shut. Why is that? This guy, Weisskopf's his name. Ash Weisskopf. Anyway, this guy's one of their best earners. The guy who was bumped off is the cousin of this Irish cop who's been after Weisskopf for years but could never find a charge that would stick. He's got it in for Weisskopf and figures he's got him good this time. Bob thought, Harry's a sucker, an unknown, and he and Rose are expecting a baby. They need money. Leave it to me, pal, he said to Wasserman. Leave it to me. Give me a week. And Bob, said Wasserman, yeah, we're not worried about how this will turn out. We're taking care of the judge and a couple of jurors. Bob called Harry the next day. Hey, Harry, how you been? Treating my little sister well, I hope? Harry didn't miss the slightly sinister tone in Bob's attempt to sound casual. He was well aware of Bob's criminal activities, but despite his best efforts, Rose was still devoted to her brother and hung on to his every word. What can I do for you, Bob? Is the family well? Are your parents well? Sure, Harry, everyone is fine and dandy. I called you with a business proposition to see if you're interested. Business? What kind of business? You know I'm not into your kind of business, Bob. I've made no secret of that. Harry was in one of the law practices on Pitkin Avenue that let him use some office space. There was practically no privacy in the office. Bob could hear the secretaries chatting and the typewriters clicking. He'd recently made the mistake of telling Rose that one or the other of the secretaries flirted with him. After that, she'd made sure to visit the office from time to time so they could see their competition. Well, you see, Harry, Bob continued, I got this pal in New York. He told me about a guy named Ash Weisskopf who's in big trouble. He's up on a murder charge. He's a small-time loan shark who never hurt nobody. But he grew up with some guys who the cops always keep their eyes on. They don't want him to go to the chair just because he knows them and are willing to pay well. Anyway, the cops got it wrong this time. Weisskopf's innocent, needs a smart lawyer. So, of course, I thought of you. I know you and Rose could use some extra money, expecting a baby and all. I figured I'd try to throw some business your way. What's the catch, Bob? Asked Harry, sitting on the corner of the desk, occasionally glancing up to make sure the secretaries weren't listening. No catch, Harry. Don't worry. You should be able to take care of this easy, and my friends are going to pay you a lot of dough. Come on, you'll be doing me a favor, and you'll have some money in your pocket to spoil Rosie and buy a nice crib for the baby. Bob was practically pleading now while trying to sound magnanimous. He knew Harry was perfect for the job. Okay, Bob, have someone send me the particulars and I'll look into them. When does this guy have to be in court? Gee, that's great, Harry. I really appreciate this. I'll have my guy send a courier to you in the next couple of days. Trial's not for a while. Plenty of time. Gotta go now, Harry. Give my love to Rosie. Thanks again. Harry put down the phone and looked up to find all the secretaries looking at him. He smiled at them, got off the desk, and went to get a cup of coffee at the Chock Full of Nuts around the corner. He had a lot to think about. Fashionable Pitkin Avenue was a perfect place for law offices and meeting clients. Harry had had more than a few important meetings at coffee shops in the area. The street bustled with crowds at all times of the day and night. When he was there, he felt part of that world. He felt successful, even if he didn't make enough money to buy anything there. He and Rose shopped from the pushcarts on Belmont Avenue. Bob called me today, Harry told Rose as they ate supper together that evening. Oh, yes? I didn't know you talked to each other, said Rose, adding salt to her roasted kasha. We don't, or we didn't. You know, I've never liked any of your brothers, except maybe Izzy. I don't know why. They're good to me. Anyway, what did Bob say? He wants to give me a case. I'm not sure, though. I'm not sure why he wants me, even though this guy lives in New York. A case? That's wonderful, Harry. Just in time for the baby. We need the money. You're going to take it, right? I'll give it some thought. What's there to think about? Harry decided to take the case. It was true they needed the money, and he was also excited to be going back into a courtroom. He hadn't been in one since he'd left Maryland. His work since then had involved filing briefs and contracts, settling disputes in conference rooms. Bob arranged for a courier to deliver the materials to Harry at home, with some upfront money included. Rose used some of it to buy a small crib and some cloth diapers. When Harry, who was furiously working on the case, periodically came up for air to check, he noticed Rose was having a difficult pregnancy. She said she was nauseous most of the time and had a hard time keeping up her strength. He suggested that she stop working in the hospital, but Rose insisted on doing a little private duty on the weekends to help pay the bills. In April, after a long labor, Rose gave birth to Abby, healthy and normal, in the same hospital where she had worked. Harry had no experience with babies, but he thought she was a difficult child. She didn't sleep much and cried often. In later years, when he had too much time to think about his mistakes, Harry recalled with shame the many times he told Rose to quiet Abby or take her outside. He couldn't concentrate when Abby was crying and complaining. Rose probably lavished attention on Abby to compensate for Harry's impatience. When he looked back, he blamed himself for not helping out more with Abby. But after all, he was a father. He was supposed to earn a living. Rose was supposed to take care of the children. She gave Abby too much attention from the time she was born. Maybe Abby would have turned out differently if he had paid more attention. Instead, Harry had become completely engrossed in the Weisskopf case. He was determined to do a good job, and perhaps that would lead to other work. He liked criminal law. It was interesting and paid well. Harry spent a lot of time at his makeshift desk in the corner of the living room. He visited his client in jail and interviewed witnesses. Ash Weisskopf was a short, chubby, pale wastrel in early middle age, with receding light hair and light blue eyes. He had a habit of glancing around the room while talking, as if he expected someone to sneak up on him. He'd been born in Brooklyn, but had an accent that hinted at Polish ancestry. Pleasure to meet you, Mr. Weisskopf. My name is Harry Leibowitz. I'm sure you've been told, unless you prefer someone else. No, sir. Thanks for helping me. I'm innocent. I didn't kill anyone. I'm happy to hear it. Now let's get down to business. Tell me what happened. Well, this Irish cop, O'Malley, has it in for me for a long time now. He arrested me before, but he didn't have enough evidence. What did he arrest you for last time? Petty larceny. It was a case of false identity. What happened this time? Well, this guy owed me money. He runs a hardware store downtown. I go to his store and tell him to pay up. Then I leave. Next thing I know, they're saying I beat up the guy and killed him. Truth is, he closed the store at the end of the day and someone on the street beat him up. Probably just had the bad luck to run into a mugger. I never killed anyone, but this Irish cop is the guy's cousin. He says I did it and is accusing me of all sorts of things now. The few witnesses Harry interviewed confirmed Weisskopf's story. Some said they'd seen Weisskopf enter the store and leave a few minutes later. Others said they saw a strange man outside the store in the evening after closing time. Each story was like an echo of another. Bob called Harry occasionally to check up on the case. How's it going, Harry? I'm counting on you winning, said Bob. You know I can't discuss it with you. Why do you even ask? Well, you need anything at all, just ask. You know where I am. Harry was excited to be working on a case with some teeth. He enjoyed the detective work involved in preparing it. He discovered that Ash Weisskopf had been in a lot of trouble with the law, but somehow he'd always managed to get off without any convictions. Harry was surprised, despite Bob's explanations, that he wanted Harry for the job. He figured they were either pretty sure Weisskopf would get off this time, or Bob really thought Harry was a good lawyer. Harry wasn't inclined to believe the latter. Bob always had an ulterior motive. But Harry couldn't afford to think about that too much. In the meantime, Bob's buddies were working hard to make sure he wasn't convicted. Bob's old buddy, Detective Wasserman, was working at a Brooklyn precinct and taking bribes for a murder incorporated on the side. He and Bob spoke frequently by phone. Wasserman told Bob that bribing the judge had been easy, almost too easy. "We had the judge followed and then sent him a nice note marked confidential," said Wasserman. "He needs to remember what he's supposed to do and that we already gave him partial payment. We also got the juror list. We've got an inside guy at the courthouse who's picked four jurors who might respond to a little persuasion." Goons cornered the first two guys in an alleyway and offered them money, which they wisely accepted. The third juror had a woman on the side. He kept her in a swanky apartment on Fifth Avenue and visited her two nights a week till it was time to take the late subway home to Brooklyn. He agreed to vote for Weisskopf's innocence if his secret life remained secret. The last guy was not so easy. He was single and clean as far as Wasserman could figure. He didn't have a mistress or a hidden past. Still, the inside man in the courthouse figured he was a loner, naive, someone who wouldn't want any trouble. They roughed him up a little until he made the right decision. On his first day in court, Harry sauntered to the desk, trying to look confident as much for himself as for his client. Weisskopf always treated Harry with respect, though his strong, Polish-tinted Brooklynese was incomprehensible to almost anyone outside of New York. Weisskopf knew the fix was in and was amused by Harry's naivete and earnestness. He tried to look worried in the courtroom for Harry's sake and to make the sham proceedings look convincing. When it was over, he'd owe more favors to his so-called pals and would have to put the squeeze on even more businesses for them. Judge Milton was also keeping up appearances. This was not the first time he'd been bribed. It was how one survived. He had to make it look real. So he put Harry and the prosecutor through their paces, asking them at one point to meet in his chambers to mull over a particularly sticky point of legal language. Then, after 2 days, he sent the jury out with the standard instructions. Unlike Weisskopf, Judge Milton didn't know the whole plan, only his part in it. He didn't know the jurors had also been coerced and figured it was all on him to ensure that Weisskopf was found innocent. He subtly undermined the prosecution's efforts to discredit the defense's witnesses while treading carefully to make everything look legitimate. The jury deliberated for 4 hours. The four bench jurors had been told to avoid stating their views too quickly, and the goons had told them to make it look like they needed some convincing before voting innocent. The jurors were told to appear thoughtful and reflective, like they had really given the case a lot of thought. Harry was thrilled when Judge Milton announced the verdict, innocent on all charges. He shook hands with Ash Weisskopf, who thanked him profusely. Harry attributed the win to his hard work and diligence. He collected the rest of his fee and went home to Rose, a happy man.